So this is Winifred Lewis, and I'm interviewing
Klaus Boonke, a little bit different from an American or Anglo sound, my last name, but I'm Klaus. And maybe I should say, looking at who would hear what I have to say, that I'm 59 years old, so I'm a little beyond my student age, and I have been active in the peace area, both activism and research, not so much teaching, since I would say something like 1983. At that time, so it's now well than a quarter century that I've been engaged in the field. I currently hold the position of chair of the German Peace Psychology Association, and all the other things don't matter at the moment.
And how did you get into peace psychology?
Well, actually, the activism phase was coming in my here you would say graduate student years. In Germany at that time, you would, as an MA student, you would already work on the job if you were in academia. So I was working on my PhD as a research associate at one of the German universities, and at the same time there was this deployment of nuclear missiles in Germany, the cruise missiles and Pershings, and the peace movement was very active. I should say, though, that I come from a dogmatic pacifist household, and so that I was active in the peace movement was kind of a genuine fading in. I had also been active in, to some degree, during my high school student years. But the merging of my activism and my interest in peace psychology came more or less as part of my job as a research associate at the very same time where I had to be very active.
Yeah, neat. And how does that work now? Is peace psychology part of your professional life? Do you get paid to do peace psychology?
Not under the label peace psychology. I wandered through the academic world. I have had my PhD in psychology, but I never was a psychology professor. I had an assistant and associate professorship in education. Then I became a sociology professor, and then I have now a chair in social science methodology, so I torture people with stats, but also with qualitative methods and
great
things like that.
I also teach stats.
So actually what I would say, I always had to pretend that peace psychology is just a natural part of what I'm doing. I have an ongoing study that is a longitudinal study going on since 1985, and I use that as material in my, say, panel data analysis teaching, or I used it in telling people about how you write scientific articles and things like that. I have never taught in a formal program where peace psychology was, say, a curriculum element. That never happened, and I don't even think it will easily happen, because peace psychology is a niche subject, and it will only be part of things that have a bigger thrust, like psychology and political processes, or political socialization, or something like that. I don't think that there is, and I don't even think it's a good road to take to establish, say, an MA in peace psychology. I think that would be too narrow, and too much in the danger of being seen as, an assembly of weirdos, or something like that.
Yeah, that's constant over-specialization, as we were talking earlier, that students and professionals stop speaking to each other and, you know, contributing to the broader world. So right now, when you do your peace psychology, you were saying it's not so much a focus of your teaching, but it is part of your research, the longitudinal data in particular. Is there other peace psych research that you have going on?
Well, actually, it depends very much on how narrowly and how broadly you define peace psychology. This is an ever recurring topic. Yeah. I have been doing research on xenophobia, on racism, on ethnocentrism, on how immigrants are treated in a modern immigration society that Germany has become, meanwhile, not as strongly as Australia, but has also become, and it poses a lot of questions of. Also, right-wing extremism is, of course, a topic in Germany for historic reasons already that was hot on my research agenda. So
yeah.
I've done in these, you could either say, genuine parts of peace psychology or in neighboring topical areas, I've actually done most of my research work.
Yeah. And that's a question that I've been asking the academics, but partly with an eye to informing students and PhD students who might be interested. Like, where does this stuff get published and so on? How do you decide whether to send something to a journal of sociology or a journal of mainstream social psychology or a journal of peace psychology?
Well,
how do you make those decisions?
Well, this is a tough one, and I think there are also cultures that are very, very different. And you have to learn this, and you have to decide to what extent you want to adhere to this. Let me say what I mean. I think when I look back on, say, my voluminous number of publications, and then I look at these fashionable collections of how often are they cited and things like that, I have a deplorably low impact, although I have published a huge number of papers.
Yeah.
Say something like 300 papers,
wow.
and they are cited on average, not all of them, of course, but cited on average once.
Yeah.
This is something. If you start a career, I would nowadays encourage everybody, knowing that you need a lot of courage to do that, I would always ask my students, the people who work with me, and also I'm asking that myself, go up high.
Yeah.
Don't go, you go to submit to, in the social psychology sphere, submit to the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, you'll get a bloody nose, for sure.
Yeah.
I've had this bloody nose.
Yeah.
And but then you may be going to the next, to the the bulletin, the Personality and Social Psychology bulletin or something. If you go, say, to Peace and Conflict, the Journal of Division 48 of the American Psychological Association, you will fairly easily get published. But that journal, of which I was a consulting editor for 10 years now, is not really read by the people who should read the peace stuff.
Yeah.
It's not so necessary that we, the good people, read the stuff, but it's important that the world out there reads the stuff. So I think now deciding between academic disciplines is yet tougher. This depends very much, I think, on whom you publish with. It has become more and more a custom that you don't prepare scientific journals all on your own.
Yeah.
Sometimes the professor and the student, but sometimes also the professor with the colleague from another academic discipline. I've had a publication in the American Journal of Sociology that I probably would not have facilitated myself, but I got to know a fairly prominent sociologist who then got, with him, I got my topic into that. So I think this is very important that you don't head low. Don't just publish in, say, I don't want to offend anybody, but the Minnesota State University Observer or something like that. This is nice. If you have time for spin off something, then go into, say, public interest or even newspapers or outlets.
Yeah.
But if you want to have a scientific impact, try to put it into journals that have a high impact, that are highly prone to reject your stuff at the first try, because they do that with about 90% of the submissions. So it's not your personal inability to be good. It's 90% of the journals, in the good journals, 90% of the submissions are rejected. And even in the say B plus journals, it's still two thirds of the submissions. I currently am editor of the International Journal of Psychology, and I have not ever seen a straightforward acceptance of a manuscript.
Yeah, that's right. My colleague Matthew Hornsey says to the students, but also of course to us junior academics, are that the best predictor of acceptance is number of rejections, because if you're not sending them out to the journals that reject them, you're not aiming high enough. And I think I think
it's always and whoever brags that he or she has never had a rejection, it just hasn't submitted high enough or often enough.
Exactly.
And this will happen to everyone, and it is
it's part of the game process.
And it's tough.
Yeah.
And you sometimes say, what I'm doing this all for, everywhere. But it needs to be done.
Yeah. Just relatedly, we might as well talk about this now. I mean, it sounds as though in Europe, as in Australia, there's no mainstream area of academic peace psychology. If you wanted to get into this area, you really have two options. One is to work as a practitioner. But if you want to come into academia, you have to base yourself in social psychology or in another mainstream discipline and then branch or arc into that area. But you're not necessarily going to be hired in peace psychology. Is that the case, or am I over?
That is, no. You're pinpointing exactly what's the case. I think there's no way to have a... There wouldn't be a chair of peace psychology. Yeah. I don't know of one.
Yeah.
And I know that at several universities, the University of Massachusetts is probably the only one
that has
a social psychology specialization in peace psychology. There's another one in Indonesia, but probably not many of us have the opportunity to go there. But that's the two I know of. There's none in Germany. There's some... there's some people who run graduate programs, doctoral programs actually, who are very well known as being involved in peace psychology, but they have a chair in social psychology, a chair in socialization research, more to the sociology edge of it. Then developmental psychology in Germany. It's not so much the community and clinical psychology where it is, but also that the long-term chair of the German Peace Psychology Association was a community psychologist and clinical psychologist. So, yes, you have to piggyback in a way on a major discipline, and then be persistent and do it all the time. Don't hide it.
Yeah.
People will usually judge your work on the grounds of the quality, not of the topic. I have never seen anybody lately. May have been during the Cold War era, yes, but not anymore. The Cold War is gone. Where you chose a topic and you were rejected because of the topic. No. You have to be good, you have to be very good, but if your topic is peace psychology, that will be recognized as well.
Yeah. Well, I guess that persistence is something that you would identify as the kind of personal quality or professional skills most valuable to you in this work.
Yeah, that's right. For example, this 25-year longitudinal study I had already mentioned.
Yeah, inspiring.
I never got any formal funding for that. I was always trying to get additional funds in a way that... that 5,000 euros there, 2,000 euros there,
yeah.
Maybe sneak it into a larger research project I have or something. So, yes, you have to be persistent, but it pays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what are you doing about activism and community work? Or putting it another way, I mean, how do you translate what you do? Or do you translate what you do back into those groups or that experience?
Yes, but now, I mentioned my age at the beginning, now it is very much a being there as a senior advisor or
yeah.
telling about my work. There's, of course, there's not... Well, there's no hot peace conflict within Germany at the moment, in the sense that we need to be in the streets very
yeah.
often. Of course, I am and would be in the streets if that happened. For
yeah.
example, if we've done something, I've been a just a normal single activist in the streets against the Afghanistan involvement of the German army.
Yeah.
But it's not that extremely hard a topic. So at my age, you typically then feed knowledge into activist groups. I can also not pretend that I do that extremely often. It's
yeah.
I do admit that I reside in the ivory tower and try to get an influence with my work
yeah.
and hope that it's and now meanwhile also know that it's read and this is something that you can only do in your later career. I think in earlier in your career, I think it's for your own mental health. I would
yeah.
even say it's important that you dance on two parties later,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I would agree there. Susie, who is, of course, the co-designer of the questions, has this hilarious question. What is the best thing that you've discovered? I always find that very difficult to answer as a researcher or as an activist, but is there something that you remember as a happy time in your kind of peace psychology?
Sure. It's actually the current analyses we've been doing in recent months that in this longitudinal study that where we asked on average 14-year-olds in 1985 to what degree they were active in peace movement activities, and we have followed them for at the moment till this very moment, but we're currently only analyzing the data until 2006. And we can show that among those who were at their mid-adolescence experiencing a strong threat of, say, the Third World War being around the corner, and then were active in the peace movement, these are the people that are significantly better off 25 years later.
Yeah,
and
it's a great finding.
If I can then say, okay, if you are reasonable and a reasonable analyst about the world out there, and if you take your analyses to action, and that is then a basis for a healthy development, what can you want more?
I know. That is great. As I was saying, that's my favorite empirical finding in the entire conference so far.
Yeah, and that's for example, I have tried to sell that to JPSP, the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, and they reject it.
Yeah.
So I went down just one to PSPB, and there I got a very promising revise and resubmit.
Oh,
so I'm
great.
Doing some,
fingers crossed.
I'm doing some serious revision, because the revision remarks were very helpful.
I think
we missed some points on our analysis. So, but yes, I think I that is a happy moment.
Yeah. Great. I'm scanning these questions now to see what I haven't asked yet. One of them is what the experience of doing the work means for you as a person and as a psychologist. Has it changed how you live your life?
There's a certain feel-good element in it.
Yeah.
Because, of course, I have, over the time, and now that I'm an established, also well-paid researcher, it has always given me an internal pleasure that I have never... That's my feeling. It's called my subjective self-evaluation, that I have never deserted my original cause in order to more easily make a career. And I think so, I think it hasn't, peace psychology hasn't changed my life in a sense that it there's some revelation or whatever, mm-hmm. but in the sense that it gave me a, well, in Germany we would probably say it earthed me. It kind of gave me, a basis for feeling good. In academia, you often have to do things that, well, it needs compromises.
Yeah.
Because, well, not that you do unethical things at all. I wouldn't think that I ever did, but you have to do so many things. They're sitting so much time in bodies that really don't discuss anything important. And then you have to spend so much time on getting new money for some things that are necessary for your institution or something like that.
Yeah.
And their peace psychology always gave me a, let me use a metaphor, a lamppost to hold on to,
in a sense.
And in that sense, it did change my life, but not in the sense of I became a different person through peace psychology, because as I said, I was brought up in a family that was, never touch a gun, and I've never done that, and not even a toy gun, and not on the fun fair, and anything like that. So no, peace psychology came from within, but it held me on track, actually. Mm.
That seems like a fabulous point to end. Is there anything else that you wanted to say? Thank you so much for this interview.
Well, thank you for being interviewed, mm-hmm. and I don't, for the people who might listen to that, I would always say, don't give up. It's worth it. It's even if sometimes you lose sight of what you're doing, you will gain it back, and it gives you a clear track.
Okay. Great. Thank you.